From WIPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. Before baking powder, breads and cakes made with yeast took hours to rise. Baking powder changed not only how much time Americans spent in the kitchen, but also what we ate. Still, the path of this ingredient to our pantry shelves was bumpy. Food historian Linda Civitello's new book is Baking Powder Wars, the cutthroat food fight that revolutionized cooking. She isn't exaggerating when she calls it a war. One brand even sold fake stories to newspapers to discredit a competitor.
And you see headlines like, "Is the bread that we eat poisoned?" Inquiring families want to know, and they'd run articles about people who were poisoned by powders that were brought to the house by traveling salesmen.
The rise of baking powder, On the Record, after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. You may be in the kitchen right now, or you have been during the holiday season, measuring out cups of flour and teaspoons of vanilla, dashes of nutmeg or cinnamon. And whether it's a bread or cookies or a cake, the recipe is likely to call for baking powder. Baking powder is a chemical leavener, achieving what yeast does, but faster and easier. The rise of baking powder coincided with advances in technology and commercial food production and meant cheaper food with less time spent in the kitchen. Last year, we spoke about the checkered history of baking powder and its impact on American cooking and eating with Linda Civitello, professor of food history. She had recently published Baking Powder Wars, the cutthroat food fight that revolutionized cooking. I asked her, when we buy baking powder today, what does the can contain?
All baking powder contains two ingredients, baking soda and cornstarch, which is a buffer to prevent the baking soda from reacting and blowing the lid off the can, with the third ingredient, which is some kind of an acid. And the most common is sodium aluminum sulfate.
Okay, so there's those three things, of which cornstarch is really kind of inert. And you mentioned baking soda. What's the difference between baking powder and baking soda?
Baking powder contains baking soda. And sometimes you'll see recipes that call for baking powder and baking soda. Baking soda reacts better with things that are acidic. So, for example, if you're using buttermilk in a recipe like a quick bread or a cornbread, usually it will call for baking soda. Or things with chocolate, which we don't often think of as acidic, but it will be baking soda. And baking powder will react with everything else. It will react with what recipe books used to call sweet milk as opposed to sour milk. And it will do its leavening job.
So you cannot substitute baking soda for baking powder. You'll be missing the acid.
Sometimes you'd have to put so much baking soda in that it wouldn't work, or you can taste it. You know, you can taste baking soda. It's salty. So, no, when baking powder showed up, I mean, women practically had parties in the street. I mean, they had been looking for so long for something to relieve them of the burden of yeast, which it would take all day to make bread. And baking powder biscuits, there they it is, right there in the name. You know, 20 minutes, hot, fresh bread. This is America's bread.
So it was before baking powder showed up, it was yeast. Eggs also help things rise?
Yes, but think about this. Before even, forget electric mixers, which didn't become popular in kitchens until 100 years ago in the 1920s. In 1870, you had a rotary beater, that hand mixer thing that looks like a, you know, it's like almost like a bicycle where you turn it yourself with your hands and it whips up everything. Before that, it was you used twigs or a fork or your hands. But the recipes say eggs must be beat into a raging foam and, you know, beat eggs for half an hour. And some of the recipes say flat out, have a male servant do this.
Oh, that would work in our household.
Yeah. Yeah, who hasn't got, you know, one of those stashed somewhere? I'm sure every woman is looking at this cookbook going, thank you. Thank you for nothing.
So you mentioned the exultation in the streets when baking powder showed up because bread was such a big part of people's diets. The average family in the 1800s, you write, consumed 28 pounds of bread per week.
That was a small family. At the beginning of the 19th century, it would be a pound of bread per person per day. So it's not like, would you like some bread with that? It's, would you like something with the bread? And very often what you got with the bread was a beverage. You know, you got tea or milk or water. You know, these are subsistence in many places. Then wealth started to come in and you got refined white flour. But flour did not grow well in New England, so they were using corn and rye. And this is one of the reasons that baking powder first shows up in New England, because corn and rye don't have gluten. Corn doesn't have gluten at all. Corn and yeast, you put them in the same room, they're on different planets. Rye has weak gluten. Yeast does very little there. You put baking powder in there and you get a lift. Baking powder does its job. There you go.
And yeast really can't with those grains.
Yeah.
When you're talking about labor like this, the production of bread was strongly tied to religious and social views about women's roles as mothers and wives.
Oh, especially by Sylvester Graham. And then women internalized it, and women spread this message of only the mother can make bread. It is she who loves her family. And Catherine Beecher said it would be worse to have a bad bread come out of your oven than to wear a dress out of fashion. You know, you're a failure. You're a failure as a woman, as a mother, as a wife. I mean,
let me play some of these people. This is Catherine Beecher related to Harriet Beecher Stowe?
Sister.
And Graham, this is as of Graham Flower.
Right, and crackers.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with food historian Linda Civitello about her book, Baking Powder Wars, the cutthroat food fight that revolutionized cooking. One of the first cookbooks written by an American, Amelia Simmons, was published. She references an ingredient called pearl ash. What was pearl ash?
Right. Amelia Simmons wrote the first cookbook in America. Cookbooks had been published here, but they were written in England. And Simmons, in Hartford, Connecticut, in 1796, publishes this absolutely revolutionary cookbook with no indication that what she's doing is out of the ordinary. And she has recipes for pearl ash, which is ash. It was made from burned vegetable matter, and women use this as a leavener. It's kind of like lye in lutefisk or lye used in corn that the Aztecs used. And this was just an indication that women wanted a shortcut. So this is where it comes from first. It comes from the women.
And that ingredient, pearl ash, predecessor of modern baking powder, was awarded the first ever patent by the new United States in 1790.
Yes. That's how important it was. It was also potash, which was used in glass making and soap making and, you know, lots of other things. But pearl ash had serious, serious drawbacks because if you didn't mix it enough, you got flakes and flecks in your food that you could taste. And one of the cookbooks says flat out, you know, after you mix the pearl ash with water, if you spill it on the floor, don't leave it, because it will strip the paint off the floorboards.
And this is an ingredient you're putting into your baked goods.
Yeah.
Well, let's fast forward a bit, and I want to get into this cutthroat fight you write about. After advances in chemistry, new compounds were patented, and in the late 1800s, several baking powder companies emerged, hawking different formulas, one with cream of tartar and one with a chemical called alum. How were they different?
Cream of tartar was made from a byproduct of wine production, and it was imported, and it was expensive, and it was a weak leavener. It was a weak acid. It had one reaction, and baking soda has one reaction. They both react with liquid. So if you are making something, a cake, if you put the baking soda in, you can see it start to work, and cream of tartar was the same. This meant that if there was any kind of delay in getting your cake into the oven, it would rise and then it would fall. I mean, the leavening power would be gone. So the recipes say, put this in the oven immediately. This is why the main baking powder still in the world is what is called a double-acting baking powder, because the first reaction is the baking soda when it hits the liquid, and the second reaction is the heat when it hits the oven. And that's why we turn on that oven light, and we look in the window, and we go, oh, look, it's rising. And we would just love to see that happening. Double-acting is just the default now. The baking powders that were single-acting are gone.
And what about alum? What is alum?
That's the sodium aluminum sulfate that I mentioned earlier, and that's too long, sodium aluminum sulfate. So it got reduced to SAS, or just alum. But it is not a true alum, which makes your mouth pucker up. They're different animals. It's a mineral. It's mined in the United States, and it's an excellent leavener. So it was cheaper than cream of tartar because it didn't have to be imported and it wasn't dependent on the vagaries of wine production. And it could just be easily found in the United States inexpensively. And it was much stronger than cream of tartar as a leavening agent.
The Royal Baking Powder Company sold a cream of tartar formula, and in order to discredit the other brand, started a major advertising campaign against formulas including alum. What did they tell the public about alum?
They said it was a poison. They had headlines that they sent news out. This was totally fake news, and they knew it at the time. They paid the newspapers, these small-town newspapers that needed the revenue, to run these stories in the news section, not as advertising. And you see headlines like, is the bread that we eat poisoned? Inquiring families want to know, and is it alum or is it malaria? They'd run articles about people who were poisoned by powders that were brought to the house by traveling salesmen. And sometimes they'd name people by names, and even when these people wrote into the newspaper and said nothing happened, and their doctor wrote in and said nothing happened, they're all fine. You know, somebody had a stomach ache, it was nothing, you know, or even nobody had a stomach ache, there was nothing at all. And the newspaper would say, we can't print the retraction, we have a contract with Royal that says that they pay us to print good information about them, and we can't print retractions.
Wow. We have to take a quick break here on the record. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with food historian Linda Civitello. When we come back, bribing state lawmakers, spying on competitors, a boycott by the Ku Klux Klan. More on baking powder wars, the cutthroat food fight that revolutionized cooking. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Bread, cake, donuts, biscuits. In all of these foods is an invisible and indispensable ingredient, baking powder. I'm speaking with food historian Linda Civitello, author of Baking Powder Wars, the cutthroat food fight that revolutionized cooking. In her book, she explores how the rise of baking powder, little pun there, the rise of baking powder, coincided with changes in the role of women in the labor force, as well as changes in the American diet, in chemistry, and in government regulation of advertising and business. The Royal Baking Powder Company hired spies to infiltrate their competitors and tried to get states to outlaw alum. Was the effort to ban alum successful?
No, it was not. It was exposed. I mean, they flat out bribed the state senate of Missouri. And Royal got the Missouri state senate to pass a law making all of its competitors' products illegal. It's a dream. It's a business dream because your competitors' products are taken off the shelves. And we're talking about, this was in 1899, $1 million worth of product, which was a lot of money then.
We're talking $1 million in Missouri?
Yeah, just on the shelves in Missouri. And your competitors' products are gone. And if your competitors continue to manufacture, if they're local small manufacturers, mom and pop, you know, grocery stores making their own brand of baking powder, if they continue to do that, they're going to be arrested. People were arrested for selling baking powder. It happened in Los Angeles also in 1904. And people went to trial over baking powder. There were cases that went to the United States Supreme Court over baking powder.
That is a war, yeah. So Royal is waging this campaign, and the advertising industry was changing, and companies were taking all kinds of steps to promote their products. Describe how baking powder companies advertised.
Oh, they advertised everywhere. There are cake pans, there are measuring utensils, there were demonstrations for women to come to so that you could show them how the product worked. Women were not in advertising, but in cookbooks explaining to each other how to use them. And then the baking powder companies were writing their own cookbooks. This was huge in the 19th century United States as new products came in. In any industry, there were pamphlets that were produced, just proprietary, because these baking powders were not interchangeable. You would need twice as much Royal baking powder as you would one of the alum brands like Calumet and later Clabber Girl, although now they're all the same, or there would be no consistency in cookbooks. You wouldn't be able to write a cookbook. And that was a problem in the 19th century. If you had a cookbook that had been written by Royal and you used an alum-based baking powder, it would be ruined. And likewise, if you had a cookbook written by one of the other baking powder companies and you used Royal, you get a terrible result. So women were very, very vociferous and enraged, many of them, and taking sides in this baking powder war. And the home economists were for Royal. And then other women were going, I've been using this for years and my family likes it and my biscuits rise higher. And just, you had this going on throughout the country. And, you know, the names were there. The name was, Royal was there in the street. When you went across the street, it was stenciled on the curb. It was written on stairways. The house to house, the traveling salesman, you would have a man in charge of a group, maybe five or six women, and they would go to a neighborhood and fan out and knock on doors, leave samples, and explain. And they would go in and say, we're not representing any particular baking powder company. We just want to show you what works. And you got into terrible controversies with this because Calumet baking powder at that time contained albumin, which is egg white, which will foam up like crazy. And the others didn't. So they could be full strength, but they wouldn't have this big head of foam on them. And Calumet could say, look, I mean, you know, the evidence is clear. And then Royal could say, look, ours is not adulterated. And everybody had a scam. And they used trade cards, you know, with pictures on them and reasons you should buy their baking powder. So magazines, tremendous magazine advertising, newspaper advertising. So it was everywhere. These were household words. And the baking powder war was known to everyone, men and women in the country at the time.
Some of the images used to advertise baking powder made use of stereotypically racist images.
Yes. Yeah. Racism in the cookbooks is prevalent. The mammy, the happy slave, you know, connected to pancakes, biscuits, baking powder, trade cards use these. Some of the baking powder companies used comic strips that were racist. It's absolutely everywhere in the food world at that time. And unfortunately, it's not all gone. In one place in the cookbooks connected to Maryland biscuit, which was a beaten biscuit that had to be beaten for 2 to 3 hours. This is because there is no leavening. And the way you leavened the biscuit
was before baking powder.
Before baking powder, right around the 1840s, we see this in cookbooks and 50s on the eve of the Civil War, where it becomes an issue because you have to beat this with a rolling pin or an axe handle or something until the air, this is how you incorporate air into the flour, in the water, in the lard to get your biscuit to rise. And the cookbook says flat out, this must go on for 2 or 3 hours. And women in the North who wrote cookbooks were appalled by this. And they said, you're better off to eat corn, just eat a cornbread. And then one of them published a recipe by a Black woman and named her and said, eat this from Aunt Lydia instead of this beaten biscuit. So you had a huge difference in the labor force between the North and the South. In the South, people who could afford beaten biscuits could afford slaves to make them for them. And in the North, women had to do most of their own labor. So they were looking for shortcuts in the North.
That's food historian Linda Civitello here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her book, Baking Powder Wars, the cutthroat food fight that revolutionized cooking. You mentioned the baking powder brand Clabber Girl. It faced a threat not from a competing baking powder producer, but from the KKK. Why?
Clabber Girls in Indiana, and in the 1920s, Indiana had the strongest Klan in the United States. In the 1924 election, the Ku Klux Klan swept the elections in the state of Indiana. The governorship, the mayors of the major cities like Indianapolis, school boards, judges, and of course, the people who were elected to these offices had power of appointment. And there was also something new, which was a women's Klan. And then there were children's Klan organizations. And anybody who was an immigrant or Catholic or Jewish or not white was a target of the Klan. And the goal was to drive them out of business, drive them out of the state, and, you know, make the state safe for 100 percenters was what the Klan called themselves and the businessmen that they supported. And here comes Clabber Girl, which is a German immigrant family that is now in the maybe second, even third generation. But they are still bringing people over from Germany that are relatives or people they want to help out. And they start them out in the office or sweeping up or something and, you know, help them to become Americans. And the Clabber Girl family, the Holman family, was Catholic. They were very active in the philanthropic community, donating land for and money for hospitals, for churches, for convents, for many, many charities, for schools. So just generically throughout the state, anyone who was not a Klan member, and Klan membership was huge, as I said, the most organized and rigid Klan in the country at the time.
So the baking powder wars ended in 1928 after J.P. Morgan and Company entered the food industry. What happened?
Well, sort of ended. The big war between Royal and Calumet, which was the cream of tartar and the alum war, ended. But people still had, you know, these cookbooks. And also then in the 1930s, you got a price war. So it shifted from just kind of Royal against Calumet to company-wide and who's going to come out on top in the country, because the Depression just turned so many businesses upside down and also created opportunities. For example, people weren't eating full-size pies, but they'd eat small pies. And the Girl Scouts became very organized and started selling their cookies commercially throughout the country in 1934, although they'd been doing sales before that. So lots of food changes, food-related changes, and the baking powder industry got turned upside down.
So baking powder is now found in self-rising flour and in cake and biscuit mixes. Is baking powder mostly sold to commercial food producers rather than home cooks?
Both. It's readily available for home cooks because, again, if you're making, you know, something with corn in it or oats or rye, you know, you're going to get some leavening out of baking powder. But it's everywhere in commercial kitchens, McDonald's, International House of Pancakes, Denny's. The donuts that we're talking about are called cake donuts. They are different from the where the donut originated in Europe, which was a puffy yeast risen. Those are the ones that are stuffed with jelly. They're like bread. It's pretty much everywhere. It's in home kitchens, it's in commercial kitchens, and it's in so many baked goods that we consume and that transform the baked goods. You look at early cakes, they're like panettone. They're yeast risen with sugar and butter and eggs and spices and maybe raisins. And how is that connected to a chocolate cake, which is American, you know? Very different in texture, different in technique, different in the time it takes to make it. We're all about speed, and baking powder gives us that.
I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Linda Civitello is a food historian and author of Baking Powder Wars, the cutthroat food fight that revolutionized cooking. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for listening. If you're celebrating Christmas, hope it's joyous. And happy baking.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.